This is BBC Radio 3. It's now 7:30. And time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Louise Fryer.
Tonight, Juanjo Mena makes his debut at the proms with the BBC Philharmonic in his role as their chief conductor, a post he holds together with the position of principal guest conductor of the Bergen Philharmonic. And there's a Nordic feel to the second part of this concert, with the UK premiere of La Terna Magica by the Finnish composer Kaija Saariaho and Sibelius's Seventh Symphony. Before that, we've music by Richard Strauss. Anna Schwanewilms will sing his four last songs. And to begin, a piece whose opening fanfare is perhaps the most arresting in the entire repertory of Western music, the monumental tone poem Also sprach Zarathustra. Strauss's starting point was a treatise by Nietzsche, in which the philosopher fervently attacked the church, suggesting a new morality to be founded on the individual. Strauss read the treatise in his late 20s and was strongly attracted by the argument that the ideal human spirit could be fearless and self-sufficient and should be free from false values of conventional behaviour. For a narrator, Nietzsche used the Persian prophet Zoroaster, who lived in the 7th and 6th centuries BC. Zoroaster pronounces on a wide range of subjects, all based around the idea that man must raise himself up to become a superman. After each pronouncement, Nietzsche concludes with the words, Also sprach Zarathustra, thus spake Zarathustra. Strauss wanted to convey Nietzsche's essential message, tracing the evolution of the human race from its origin up to that ideal of the Übermensch. He illustrates the conflict between man and nature using a different key for each, the energy of the piece generated by conflict between the two. The arresting opening sees the prophet Zarathustra living on a mountaintop, watching a new day dawning. Well, straight after that well-known opening comes the first appearance of primitive humanity from the backworldsmen with their naive belief in an afterlife. A solo viola introduces the third section of Great Longing, depicting humanity's struggle to free itself from such superstitions, and the theme of the credo is pushed aside in favour of joys and passions, which rise to a complete frenzy. Next comes the much more subdued Song of the Grave, followed by a dryly academic fugue depicting the world of science. At this point, the hero undergoes a dramatic psychological change, a moment of vibrant orchestral colour, as the convalescent leaps from his sickbed, building up to a dance song of bacchanalian ecstasy. The final section is called the Night Watchman's Song, with its tolling midnight bell. By the epilogue, man has freed himself from the bonds of religion, but the conflict with nature remains unresolved. That applause is for Yuri Tuchinsky, leader of the BBC Philharmonic, taking his place on the platform. And here comes Juanjo Mena, chief conductor of the BBC Philharmonic, taking his place to conduct them in Also sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss.
We'll be right back.
Juanjo Mena appearing for the first time at the BBC Proms since becoming chief conductor of the BBC Philharmonic last September, opening tonight's concert with Also Sprach Zarathustra by Richard Strauss, and setting his baton flying during one of the lusher bars, not that he missed a beat. Zarathustra is glorious, by far the most important of all my pieces, the most perfect in form, the richest in content, the most individual in character. The passion theme is overwhelming, the fugue spine-chilling, the dance simply delightful. In short, I'm a fine fellow after all and feel just a little pleased with myself, Strauss writing to his wife Paulina after the final rehearsal before the premiere in 1896. Juanjo Mena back on the platform, encouraging members of the orchestra to stand, including the organist Jonathan Scott. When Juanjo Mena arrived for the rehearsal today, he introduced the organ as a new animal. Certainly we heard it at its best. Juanjo Mena continuing to pick the players out of the orchestra, all of the woodwind now on their feet. And the timpanist and his fellow percussion players. And this is the organist, Jonathan Scott, standing. Piano Tuner underscore tech on Twitter certainly enjoyed its opening roar and wasn't alone. And principal trumpet Jamie Proffitt, the first to stand amongst the brass section. Along with him, principal horn Jonathan Goodall. One of the orchestra members at the time recalled Strauss arriving at the Tonhalle as a visiting conductor, where he was tall and slender, seemed more like a bank president than a composer, but his dreamy eyes and modern hairdo gave him away. He used a fairly long baton and got an expressive movement from it with a flick of the wrist. The tip of the stick had a click to it, so the rhythm was quite precise. Well, I hope that Juanjo Mena has a spare baton in his dressing room. Strauss described his score for Zarathustra as a manifestation of symphonic optimism dedicated to the 20th century. But from a mood of hope, the orchestra turns to one of resignation now, with music Strauss composed over 50 years later, when the new century had turned out to be rather less splendid than he'd hoped. It was in the aftermath of World War II. Strauss was in his 80s, exiled in northern Switzerland to avoid being called before the denazification board, and deeply depressed when his son prompted him to write what became known as his four last songs. Three are based on poems by Hermann Hesse, Spring, September, and On Going to Sleep. And the final song is a setting of a poem by Josef von Eichendorff, At Sunset. It pictures an elderly couple hand in hand as shadows spread across a darkening valley. Larks fly up into the haze, and like the birds, the couple enjoy the vast and silent peace. They seem world-weary, but content, and look forward to embracing their final rest. Death stalks through all the poems in different ways. The first concerns winter, trembling at the approach of spring. By September, the garden is in mourning, and summer shudders as it meets its end. And in the third song, On Going to Sleep, the poet offers up his longings to the starry night. Body and mind cease their strivings, and his soul ascends on untrammeled wings, the violin carrying our thoughts with it on its upward journey. The songs were dedicated to people who'd helped Strauss during his exile, but his wife Paulina, herself a singer, haunts every bar. Strauss was happily married to Paulina for 55 years. January the 17th, 1892, he described as the most wonderful day of my life. He was conducting an uncut Tristan in Weimar. Paulina, who was a house soprano, was taking the role of Isolde. Strauss married her just 2 years later in 1894, and he wrote his first songs for her as a wedding present. Strauss finished his four last songs in 1948. He was working on a fifth when he died the following year at the age of 85, so he never heard the songs aired in public. At his death, Paulina was devastated. She died just a few months later, 9 days before the first performance of the four last songs, which took place here at the Royal Albert Hall in May 1950, sung by Hirsten Flagstar with the Philharmonia, conducted by Furtwängler. We're singing them tonight, Anna Schwanewilms, the German soprano, taking her place at the front of the podium now, dressed all in red, and with her Juanjo Mena, ready to conduct the BBC Philharmonic in the four last songs by Richard Strauss. at sunset, concluding the four last songs by Richard Strauss. Strauss quoting a motif at the end there that's the transfiguration theme in his early tone poem Tod und Verklären, Death and Transfiguration. Anna Schwanewilms, the soloist here at the Royal Albert Hall with the BBC Philharmonic conducted by Hanho Mena. And in rehearsal today, Anna Schwanewilms, in those closing moments, just turned and watched the orchestra beaming. Tonight, she stood solemnly looking out at the Prommers, and very moved they were too. Hanho Mena, quick to kiss her hand and then each cheek at the end of her performance. And if you wonder what that little chuckle was between the first two songs, well, Anna Schwanewilms decided to remove her red velvet jacket and then had nowhere to put it. And Hanho Mena rather kindly offered to hang it over the rail of his conductor's podium. Strauss was to have written a fifth orchestral song, setting another poem by Hermann Hesse, but died, as I said, before it was completed. And as he lay on his deathbed, he told his daughter-in-law that dying was just as he had imagined it when writing Tod und Verklären 60 years earlier. Anna Schwanewilms, many people standing in the auditorium. She's regarded as one of the finest Strauss sopranos currently gracing international stages. The unchallenged number one among Strauss divas today, as the Berliner Morgenpost puts it. And the principal horn brought to his feet. And the leader of the orchestra, Yuri Turchinsky. Anna Schwanewilms blowing him a kiss. And she's recorded the four last songs with the Halle and Mark Elder. Mark Elder, of course, taking part in four proms this year, going from celebrations of Ivan Avello to Elgar's Apostles with the Halle in less than 24 hours, a little later in the season. Well, if you think Strauss's music is luminous, in the second half of tonight's prom, the BBC Philharmonic and Hanho Mena give the UK premiere of La Terna Magica by Kaija Saariaho, inspired by the film director Ingmar Bergman's use of light, and the prom culminates in a performance of Sibelius's seventh and final symphony. Or is it? For most of the last century, lovers of Sibelius's music have been tormented by the knowledge that he worked on and probably destroyed an eighth. Yet for the last three decades of Sibelius's life, until his death in 1957, he published little of any importance. During the next 20 minutes, writer and broadcaster Peggy Reynolds explores the reasons behind the most notorious silence in 20th century music and introduces an exclusive performance of remarkable musical fragments discovered last year of what may be Sibelius's lost Eighth Symphony.
I first came to listen to Sibelius because a dear friend of mine loved his music. He travelled the world, and if there was a Sibelius symphony on offer in Seattle, Sydney, or Seville, he never missed a concert. Sibelius attracts that kind of dedication, partly because he gave the same commitment to his work. This story starts in the 1920s, when Sibelius was still relatively young, in his late 50s, and at the peak of his creative powers. In the previous 10 years, he'd written three astonishingly original symphonies. He'd settled in the country, in a house among the lakes and forests north of Helsinki, that he named Ainola for his wife, Aino. He was calm. All the drinking and wildness of his youth were behind him. Everything was right for him to begin work on the symphony that would crown his career. But nothing happened. Until now. Conductor Sir Mark Elder.
When I first started studying Sibelius, when I was a schoolboy, I remember reading that there might have been an Eighth Symphony, but nobody had ever seen it. Nobody really could trust that he had written a note of it. And the thought that there might have been a masterpiece just beyond our grasp was tantalising. If I'm now going to hear music that actually might well be part of an Eighth Symphony, I'm on tenterhooks.
The Helsinki Music Centre, the 27th of April, 2012. It's only 10 o'clock in the morning, but this astonishing new building is buzzing. The Helsinki Philharmonic, under the baton of their chief conductor, John Storgards, are rehearsing for a concert scheduled for the 1st of May. They have also gathered to give us a performance of what might just be a part of Sibelius's Lost Eighth Symphony. The three fragments that they're about to play give us some insight into the riddle that has teased music lovers for the last 80 years. Why did this inventive composer fall silent when he should have been at his most expressive? This is the question we're going to explore. To do that, we have to place Sibelius in his context. Even in his own lifetime, Sibelius's music expressed and idealized the whole Finnish nation, and that expectation had a dramatic and traumatic impact on the composer's creativity. When Sibelius was a young man, Finland was a grand principality within the Russian Empire. Though he was no politician, Sibelius's music came to be identified with the cause of Finnish independence. He drew on the Kalevala, the Finnish national epic, and he depicted the ancient heroes in his Lemminkainen suite and Kullervo symphony. Sibelius scholar Glenda Goss explains.
The first time was in 1892, and that was with his Kullervo, Finland's very first choral symphony. And those robust male voices singing Finnish folk poems in unison gave the collective community a unified masculine voice.
But what then happens to the musical father of the nation when that dream of independence begins to be achieved and threatens to turn into a nightmare?
On the 6th of December, 1917, independence was declared. But this declaration was not pomp and circumstance and blowing trumpets and releasing balloons. It was rather understated. One reason may have been that the Finnish leaders were a little afraid of what the outcome might be. And well, they might have been. A civil war erupted. The awful specter of neighbors killing neighbors and brothers killing brothers. In Sibelius's diary, he writes about the aftermath of the war being some of the darkest days of his life.
It's no coincidence that Sibelius's decline into silence in the 1920s should follow these darkest days. But it wasn't just the problems of his native country that plagued Sibelius as he tried to go on with his work. On the larger stage, the Great War shook all of Europe, and artists of all kinds began to question the old forms. Writer and broadcaster Tom Service.
Musically speaking, there had been a kind of end of empire too. The heroes of the 1880s, 1890s, when Sibelius was growing up, would have been Richard Strauss or Brahms or Bruckner or Tchaikovsky. A completely different vision of the world and a completely different vision of what music could be than what would happen by the 1920s.
It had begun in 1913 with the famous riot that greeted the Paris premiere of The Rite of Spring. But then came the atonal experimentation of Schoenberg. Popular music grew up with the gramophone. Jazz led to improvisation and play. Sibelius may have been born in 1865, but he willingly listened to all of this and loved new ideas. As late as the 1940s and 50s, Sibelius was tuning in his state-of-the-art radio at Ainola to hear music by Stravinsky and Britten. And even in the last big complete works that we have, which date from the mid-1920s, you can hear Sibelius pushing at the bounds. Mark Elder and then Tom Service.
In that great work, Tapiola, this great impression of the god of the forests, he manages to create an atmosphere of mysterious power.
Tapiola as an experience is one of the most brutal, desperate, desolate things that's ever been written. The sort of torture that's visited upon this musical idea, it's as if any trace of human interaction or warmth has been wiped out.
The work steadily builds up until the strings are screaming like an icy Arctic wind. And the music evaporates back down into a strangely unended calm. There's something remarkable about it, his last big work for orchestra. It's the sort of piece, really, that one can only go home after it.
And that's where most history books say Sibelius' story ends. There was no more major new work. But what really happened during those years of apparent silence? Sibelius once called alcohol my most faithful companion. In his youth, he was notorious for propping up the bars at various boozy haunts around Helsinki. Now, with all the time in the world, Sibelius, so the story goes, drank himself into a permanent creative stupor. But research shows that it's not as simple as that. On the contrary, living quietly in the country at Ainola, Sibelius tried to control his drinking. But perversely, that seems to be one of the reasons for his not writing so much. Music journalist Vesa Siren.
Last summer I was lecturing in a Sibelius festival about why did he fall silent, and I was showing a film where you can see his hand writing notes. Mm-hmm. But if you look carefully, you can see that actually the pen is moving very rapidly, but it sticks to the same point to the paper.
So nothing's coming out.
Nothing's coming out. And two or three American doctors rose up and said that, that's essential tremor. I said, what?
Sibelius had been plagued all his life by what he called weak nerves, which led to a trembling in his hands. In fact, he seems to have been suffering from a genetic muscle condition, essential tremor. In the days before sophisticated medication, moderate amounts of alcohol could actually help to calm this tremor. But according to Vesa Siren, Sibelius's devoted wife Ino, who'd lived through his drunken rages, was anxious to keep him off the sauce, and she may not have realised what this meant.
Sibelius knew modest amounts of alcohol help the tremor. Now he thought that, okay, one or two glasses of wine, it's a little bit easier. Ino Sibelius was devastated. So now you are using alcohol to do the sacred artworks. Then he cannot drink alcohol because it will hurt his wife so much, which made writing notes even slower. If he used alcohol more, maybe we would have Symphony No. 8.
So there was pressure at home to keep on writing and keep off drinking. But in the wider world, there was the pressure of expectation.
He promised it to Boston Symphony Orchestra, Serge Koussevitzky, in the beginning of 1930s, and it was supposed to be ready in 3 months or next spring and so on.
He's still working on these works when he goes to Berlin again in 1931. These trips abroad were very useful because he would write Ino about what he was doing or what he wanted her to think he was doing.
In 1935, when he turned 70 years old, everybody was asking about it, and he said, it's not ready.
The Daily Telegraph talked about the Eighth Symphony having become an international news sensation. Thomas Beecham even reported that he'd finished the Eighth Symphony and was working on a Ninth.
And now is when I think Sibelius began to feel pressure.
Was this all a bluff? Maybe no notes were written down at all. And yet we do have concrete evidence that a large section of the piece must have existed on paper. Glenda Goss.
We have this receipt in September of 1933 that shows a copying of what appears to be the symphony's first movement. A few years after this, in 1936, this critic, Olin Downs, made what was his fourth visit to Sibelius, and in typical American journalist style, started asking question after question about the Eighth Symphony. And Sibelius finally exploded in German, Ich kann nicht, I cannot.
It is a terrible cry, but what does it mean? Despair at not being able, or horror at the enormity of the task? Whatever Sibelius' state of mind, he was at a point of extreme crisis. One morning in 1945, he collected various manuscripts together and took them to the big Art Nouveau fireplace in the living room at his house, Ainola. Beside that very fireplace, I asked journalist Vesa Siren about what happened that day.
He took some juvenile works and Symphony No. 8 right here, I started to throw them.
Utterly, no compromise.
Mm. Yeah. He was not the man of many compromises. Ino Sibelius was terrified. Look what the papa has done. He has burnt something. And Sibelius said, more in a humorous way, well, you know, I burnt some stuff.
And that's where the story of Sibelius and his lost Eighth Symphony ends. Or so we thought.
So here you can see already the score order of instruments.
Okay. And a separate little hand-drawn stave with timp written beside it.
At the back of the rehearsal room at the Helsinki Music Centre, I'm sitting with Timo Vatanen, Sibelius scholar, and the man who's pieced together at least part of the jigsaw that might finally lead us to the lost Eighth Symphony. Over several years, Timo has sifted through more than 800 pages of unsorted, unattributed sketches to find those that he can be certain date to the infamous Silence of Ainola. Scandinavia has its forensic detectives in music as in other fields.
On the same paper, he also marked some numbers which are actually sums of money in Finnish marks and in German Reichsmark. I have tried to ask Bank of Finland what these sums might refer to.
Because if you had the bills or the receipts for that amount of money, you'd know exactly when Sibelius wrote it.
Yes, it could help.
Oh, it's like being a detective.
Yes, really so.
By hunting down which sketches Sibelius meant for orchestra, Timo put together three short sections of a major orchestral piece, dating from after Sibelius's last published works. And we only know of one composition he worked on at this late stage, the Eighth Symphony. But having finally solved this conundrum, Timo found himself wondering whether the score could really be by the Sibelius he knew. The harmonies seemed to be too harsh, too dissonant, well, too modern.
When I started to transcribe this fragment, I didn't believe my eyes, because Sibelius writes very striking dissonant combinations.
So this work really is original, even for Sibelius?
I might say so, yes. Those dissonances really took me time to understand and in a way to accept what he had written.
When the music journalist Vesa Siren got wind of Timo Vatanen's discovery, he was hot on the trail of a scoop. He called his contacts at Helsinki's orchestras and arranged for a surprise run-through at the end of a normal afternoon rehearsal. Since that first run-through, at which some members of the orchestra reportedly burst into tears, Timo Vatanen has refined and corrected his version of the score from the original manuscripts. Today, the orchestra of the Helsinki Philharmonic, under conductor John Storgards, will play these newly edited fragments for the very first time. For Vesa Siren, and everyone else who's lived with the mystery of what it was that burned in the flames at Ainola, the performance of these tiny fragments, barely 3 minutes of music in all, is finally the answer to years of wondering.
We all had been waiting decades, and now we know there was a new direction. Oh my God, is that all?
The bleakness of the musical image is very, very characteristic. There's little ti-da-ta-da immediately remind one of the opening of the Seventh Symphony. I'd love to hear it again.
Even those few bars sounded so pregnant with absolutely authentic Sibelian possibility that it did make you think, wow, there is the seed from which a symphony could quite possibly have grown.
The second sketch, which is absolutely finished page of orchestral score, it's much more lyrical, it's, dare I say, common Sibelius. The third sketch is harmonically more daring, but he would really not appreciate us hearing this because you can see that it's not ready. The orchestration dies out, and then he only sketches the melody for the oboe at the end of it.
The music that I heard was quite astonishing, and it brings up a very interesting question. Had Sibelius come to a place that was so radical that he knew no one could follow him?
You could say what he was trying to do was trying to deal with all of the sounds that the modern world was making around him, but make a musical life form that would be completely his. Is that a reason why he couldn't finish it, because the task was simply too great? Quite possibly.
Because my friend first taught me to love it, I've admired Sibelius's music for a long time. It would be wonderful to have more. And there are many sketches still to be deciphered among the Sibelius manuscripts, and Timo Virtanen will go on working through them. But the chances of reconstructing the whole of the lost last symphony that burned in the fireplace at Ainola are slim. And maybe that is as it should be. In all the years of listening to Sibelius's music, I never really thought about him as a man. Now that I've tracked this story, listened to these witnesses, I can see his private struggle. Sibelius cared about his reputation and he wanted to have control. By burning his sketches, he kept that hold. His legacy as an artist was at stake, and for that he wanted perfection. In the end, the destruction of the Eighth Symphony may have been a loss to music, but it had a liberating effect for Sibelius the man.
For Ino herself, of course, burning these manuscripts was very terrible. But how did she talk about Sibelius's reaction afterwards?
She thought that he was much more calm. He seemed happier. He didn't have to do demonic things with alcohol abuse to keep his creative spirits alive.
So no more explosions?
No more creative explosions, maybe, but revising his old works in calm and peace.
Sibelius's Lost Eighth Revealed was presented by Peggy Reynolds and was produced in Cardiff by Stephen Rajan. This is Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. And tonight's concert, given by the BBC Philharmonic, which marks the first appearance as chief conductor by Juanjo Mena. From his Basque roots, he now looks north for the rest of the concert, ending with a Seventh Symphony by Sibelius. And before that, giving the UK premiere of a piece Kaija Saariaho wrote in 2008, La Terna Magica, inspired by the autobiography of the film director Ingmar Bergman. In an article in tonight's programme, Sarajaho says that she found the book as she was tidying her shelves the autumn before, and reading it was struck by the mechanics of the first machine that conjured the illusion of a moving image, the magic lantern, the Laterna Magica, a device which presents a series of static images and by turning a handle faster and faster creates the impression of movement. Applying that idea to music, Sarajaho was intrigued by the possibilities offered by different speeds. Fast tempos create a sense of rhythmic continuity. A slow pace is better for isolating delicate individual sounds. So rhythms with different characters create the auditory images of this music, a flamenco dance rhythm or an asymmetrical rhythm that simulates speech. And in places, rhythm is set aside completely to allow various orchestral textures to emerge as a kind of background. Sarajaho, who celebrates her 60th birthday later in the year, is known for the delicacy of her orchestrations and her spare but intense use of orchestral colour. In this piece, playing with orchestral colour, she says, replicates what Bergman did with light. And she includes in the score part of the text of Bergman's autobiography in which he describes the different types of light his favourite photographer captured. Gentle, dangerous, dreamlike, lively, dead, clear, hazy, hot, strong, naked, sudden, dark, spring-like, penetrating, pressing, direct, oblique, sensuous, overpowering, restricting, poisonous, pacifying, bright light. Light. Okaya Sarajaho is in the audience tonight and making his way to the podium to conduct the first UK performance of this work is Juanjo Mena.
Thank you. Thank you.
Laterna Magica by Kaya Saariaho, Juan Pomena conducting the BBC Philharmonic in this UK premiere performance here at the Proms. The piece not new to Mena, though. He gave the Swedish premiere of it with the Gothenburg Symphony earlier this year. Laterna Magica, written originally for Sir Simon Rattle and the Berlin Philharmonic by Kaya Saariaho, who's making her way onto the stage now, being ushered forwards by Juan Pomena. Kaya Saariaho shaking hands with the leader of the BBC Philharmonic, Yuri Chichinsky. She was interviewed before the prom by Tom Service in a Proms Plus composer portrait just across the road at the Royal College of Music. And you can hear edited highlights after this concert. That's at 10 o'clock tonight here on BBC Radio 3. And Kaya Saariaho attended IRCAM, the Centre for Research into Electroacoustic Music in Paris, and stayed on to work with the Spectralist School of Composers, breaking down the sound spectrum of individual notes on particular instruments, exploring microtonal intervals and the whole range from pure tone to white noise. Coming to the front of the stage once more, trying to beckon the conductor forward, but he's refusing to join her. Kaya Saariaho has also written operas and other works for voices. And we heard some of the voices of the players sub-vocalising, really. The woodwind section in particular now being brought to their feet, often not even using their instruments, but the flutes in particular making those curious, breathy, arid sounds. And now all the members of the BBC Philharmonic standing to receive the applause. BBC Proms, of course, keen on premieres. Well, after Saariaho, the final piece in tonight's prom is by another Finn, Sibelius. In the early years of the 20th century, rather than splitting the auditory spectrum like Saariaho, or abandoning tonality altogether as his contemporary Schoenberg was doing in Vienna, Sibelius was looking for some kind of symphonic unity. And he wrote of it as a kind of puzzle, a puzzle that he felt found a solution in his Seventh Symphony, composed in 1924. Although, as you may have heard in tonight's interval feature, he made attempts to compose other symphonies, the feeling persists that Sibelius never managed to better the structural perfection of his Seventh. Written as a single movement, it actually appeared at its first performance with the title Fantasia Symphonica and was only called a symphony the following year. Sibelius apparently encouraged to do so following the public success of the piece. Well, attempts to see it as four movements stuck together have been in vain. The writer Robert Layton sums it up as a single, indivisible organism. The piece seems to pull into one coherent whole the themes and ideas that dominated Sibelius's musical output. And there's an essential optimism of passing through struggle to affirmation. Sibelius was struggling himself at the time with alcoholism. Given prohibition in Finland, he was prescribed it medically and drank to calm his shaking hands. He wrote, "Alcohol to intoxicate nerves and mind. How tremendously tragic is the fate of an aging composer. The work doesn't flow as fast as before, and self-criticism is increasing to the point of impossibility." Well, happily, not so far as to scupper his completion of the Seventh Symphony that he conducted himself in Stockholm in March 1924, 3 months after he wrote that diary entry, and 3 weeks after he completed the piece. Sibelius then in his mid-50s. Also, Henry Wood, who founded the Proms, was a great supporter of Sibelius. He gave the UK premiere of the Seventh, and it received its first Proms outing in 1934. Don't forget, you can always delve into Proms history for yourself by searching the online database of all Prom performances at the website for the Proms, bbc.co.uk/proms/archive. Sibelius himself came to the UK. He made a trip in 1921, conducting several concerts in London, but also in Bournemouth, in Manchester and Birmingham. And that visit was enough to ensure his music won a place in the repertoire here. And to conduct one of those pieces, the Seventh Symphony, here is Juan Pomena with the BBC Philharmonic. The Seventh Symphony by Sibelius, stretching out its final cadence under the baton of Juanjo Mena, conducting the BBC Philharmonic here at the Royal Albert Hall. Juanjo Mena just completing his inaugural season with the BBC Philharmonic. He's conducted music by Mahler, Bach, Bruckner, Debussy, Takamitsu, Dvorak. His first recording featured music by Pianet and was very well received, while his second recording of works by his compatriot Manuel de Falla was singled out for numerous Disc of the Week and Editor's Choice accolades. And coming soon, a CD of music by the Catalan Xavier Montsalvatge, the centenary of whose birth we're celebrating this year. That's in the shops at the end of the summer. Juanjo Mena currently back on stage, bringing to his feet the principal trombone Richard Brown. And now encouraging the horn section to stand. And the trumpets and the rest of the trombones. Juanjo Mena picking out the sections of the orchestra one by one. Three more Sibelius symphonies will be performed here this season. The BBC Phil bringing the third and sixth with their new Finnish principal guest conductor Jon Storgårds for their last visit to this year's Proms. That's on August the 9th. And the Dark Fourth Symphony will be in one of the Berlin Philharmonic's programmes under Simon Rattle at the end of August. But the BBC Phil are back before then. That's in a week's time on Monday, July the 30th, under their conductor laureate, Gianandrea Nezeda, with another Seventh Symphony, Mahler's. But from tonight's prom, that's all. Let me hand you on to John Shea.
Louise, thank you very much. That was Louise Fryer presenting tonight's prom, and you've another chance to hear it on Thursday afternoon here on BBC Radio 3 from 2 o'clock. Of course, you can also listen again anytime you like for the next 7 days via the BBC Radio 3 website. And I believe I'm right in saying that our television colleagues were recording that one for broadcast on BBC 4 on Thursday evening. Well, we'll be returning to the Royal Albert Hall tomorrow evening a little earlier than usual at 7 o'clock for music by Fan Lam, Rachmaninoff and Prokofiev. That's a concert given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra with Jerzy Bieloklawek, the first of two proms tomorrow night at 7. And then at 10.15, there's a late-night all-Handel prom.
London, appropriately enough, is one of the themes of the 2012 BBC Proms. And midway through our first full week of the season, our first late-night prom features music by one of the city's most famous adopted sons. George Frederick Handel's three water music suites and fireworks music get the big period instrument band treatment from Hervé Niquet and Le Concert Spirituel. Up to 80 musicians joining together to evoke resplendent royal occasions on the River Thames and in Green Park. Some of London's favourite classical works come alive in tomorrow night's late-night visit to the BBC Proms, starting at 10:15.
Well, if you'd like to know more about the music of Kaija Saariaho, which we heard in the second half of tonight's prom, then stay tuned. We've a prom's composer portrait of her. She'll be in conversation with Tom Service in a little over 5 minutes from now. Before that, piano music from the earlier 20th century by the Russian Nikolai Roslavets. These pieces are simply called two compositions. They date from 1915, and the pianist here is Marc-André Amelin. Two compositions, Quasi-Prelude and Quasi-Poem, by the Russian composer Nikolai Rostovyets. They were played there by Marc-André Amelin. One small correction to what I told you earlier about tomorrow night's first prom. The BBC Symphony Orchestra will be conducted by Zachary Oromo in place of Jerzy Bialohlavek. This is BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC Proms, and one of the many features to help you get even more out of the new music that's such an important part of the summer is our series of Proms composer portraits. The first one of this season took place just before tonight's concert. It's introduced now by Tom Service.
To the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall at the Royal College of Music for the first of this season's Proms composer portraits. Now, her orchestral music is in the spotlight across the road there at the Royal Albert Hall, but with the chance now to explore the chamber music of Finnish composer Kaija Saariaho, I'm delighted to say, in the company of the composer herself. We're going to hear two pieces, both performed by the young players of the London Sinfonietta Academy Ensemble. Now, on stage here, to my left, there's really a huge battery of percussion, gongs, cymbals, a vibraphone, marimba, as well as a grand piano. All of that and a cello you'll hear in Serenatas, the second work this evening. We're going to start, though, with Tocar for violin and piano. Now, look, Kaija, Tocar, Spanish for to touch. So look, how do you make the instruments, these very different instruments, the violin and the piano, touch each other, come together sonically, musically?
Well, that was my challenge when writing this piece, and that was what I was thinking about. How can they meet? You know, to play these two instruments is so different, and so there are different ways I'm I'm making them to meet each other. And in fact, the working title for the piece was To Touch, Touching, but touching would sound very strange, and so therefore this Spanish tocar.
It's a very touching piece, though, hearing it in rehearsal. It would have made sense. But how then do you make the... I mean, I suppose the challenge then is you have the violin, a sustaining instrument, and the piano, which is, in a sense, not a sustaining instrument. So you're trying to make the piano sing to give it a resonance to partner the violin.
Yes, the piano is the background, and from the resonance of the instrument comes the violin sound. On the other hand, then... later, the speed, it's spinning quicker and quicker, and then there are, of course, the different ways that the two musicians touch their instrument and symmetrical ways too. And then finally, their musical material comes together so that the material touches each other.
Now, you wrote this piece in 2010 for the Sibelius Violin Competition. That meant, I guess, hearing the piece many times.
24 times, yes. It was great, yes.
Did you have a favourite, or were they all equally valid interpretations of Tocar?
Of course not.
They weren't?
Of course they were not. They were very, very different, and clearly some interpretations came from the teachers of these all very young musicians, and some have their own character, some had connection with the pianist, some didn't at all, and some thought that this was the inevitable boring thing that they would prefer not to do, and some seemed to really like it. So.
And what about working with the two players we're going to hear, Liz Lamberton on violin and Leanne Cody on piano? What's your impression of them? You have to say nice things now, actually.
These young musicians are really very gifted and wonderful and beautiful. I heard them yesterday. They played for the first time together yesterday. So I'm looking forward to hear how it is today.
Well, let's hear it now. Kaija Saria hosts Tocar, Liz Lamberton, the violinist, and Leanne Cody, the pianist.
Fantastic. Thank you.
That performance of Tokar by Kaya Sarriaho, the violinist Liz Lamberton and the pianist Leanne Cody. Kaya, the difference for you between thinking on an orchestral or an operatic scale and the chamber music we're hearing this evening, are they completely different things for you? Is one more public, and is music like Tokar or Serenatas, which is coming up, more private for you as an experience, as a compositional experience, and to listen to as well?
Interesting question. In a way, of course, it's always very private, because, for example, the opera subjects I have chosen, they are something which touch me personally very much. On the other hand, of course, the small chamber music pieces, I love chamber music, and I love chamber music concerts, and I like a lot small concert spaces. This is too big, you know. And I think that it's fantastic to have the really the presence. I feel that chamber music at its best is the real communication.
Okay, well, that slightly begs the question of what you reckon to the Royal Albert Hall and the other of the world's major concert halls, and indeed opera houses in which your music is frequently performed. I mean, does that mean that you think all those spaces are too big and are deficient for the kind of privacy and intimacy of communication that you want your music to have?
No. I mean, opera houses can be big, and they need to be big, and the music, the orchestra music, needs to live in a big space, of course. But I just like to point or be a little bit provocative, because today it seems that only the big stuff matters, you know, the bigger the better, as if it would have something to do with the quality. Of course it does not.
Do you think that's a problem in classical music culture, is what you mean?
Yeah, of course, it's in our whole life, you know, it's a big problem. I don't start speaking about Olympic Games now, but I think that sometimes we are really losing the human scale.
Does that mean you resist big commissions if they come in the future, because you'd rather say, look, I'd rather write for a small chamber music hall, or indeed even more radically intimate would be the space between our ears, the recordings or purely electronic music, for example, things that can only require the resonating chamber of our brains, as opposed to the Albert Hall, the Royal Albert Hall?
Well, no, I like to do both things. I like to do big things. I love to imagine for big formations, and I love to do the small things, but in fact, electronic music, not much, because I enjoy so much what the musicians give with their playing or their singing, and I miss it too much when I'm working only in studio.
Is that a change? I mean, if we think back to some of the music you wrote in the 1980s, just after you left Finland, you studied in Germany, you went to Paris to study in the IRCAM, Pierre Boulez's Centre for Electronic Music, that you sort of have to tread carefully on if you walk to the Pompidou Centre. Do you think differently about those pieces like Lichtbogen or Verblendungen, pieces that put together electronic and tape sounds with acoustic ensembles and orchestras?
Not really, because I'm doing it all the time. I just had premiere 2 weeks ago in Amsterdam for big orchestra and electronics. It still interests me, but maybe the reason in the 80s I did some pieces only with electronics was because I was discovering a lot of things and a lot of possibilities and the tunings. Certain things, it's good if you are doing it only alone in the studio, you know, the special microtonal tunings or things like that.
You see, even in some of the sounds we were hearing in Tokar there, I mean, it's sort of, some of the sounds you create remind me a little of your electronic music. I mean, the violin trills very high up there and the dense textural things that are going on in the piano. Are you aware of that influence even when you're writing for just acoustic instruments and even for small combinations of acoustic instruments?
Well, I spent a lot of time in analyzing sounds and I'm sure it affected also my instrumental writing. It's normal. I discovered certain things which really interest me and which I liked, and then I brought some of them into my music.
What kind of thing?
Well, this thing about constant life in sound, because in 18s when I was working in studios and when we were making sound synthesis, and of course it has nothing to do with the tools and means of today, but even if the ideas remain quite similar, we were able to produce sounds with machines, but they were very boring. And I wanted to understand why they were boring, and they were boring because they were too stable. And what makes the living sound so interesting is that it, as stable as musician wants to make it, it can never be stable. There are all the time micro variations. And when I started bringing this micro variation into synthetic sound, suddenly I realized that it became much more interesting.
Okay, so micro variations are a way of injecting a bit of dynamism into these otherwise static electronic sounds.
Yeah,
life,
yeah,
basically.
Yeah, that life, so-called life.
Is all that connected with feeling as well? Is there an emotional part of that imagining of sounds and serenatas? You've talked about the piece we're going to hear for cello, percussion and piano is about, you want the people to play, the musicians to play these five short pieces as if they were playing a serenade for their lover. Mm. I mean, that suggests a very deep kind of emotional narrative going on in that music as well.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, music is my life. I think about it a lot, but I have much feelings to it also. And I want to communicate my musical ideas, but I want to communicate also these feelings.
What are the feelings then that serenatas expresses these five short pieces?
In fact, serenatas is a special piece in that sense that it's a collection of obsessions. It's
obsessions
concerning musical material. I had written my cello concerto. I had written a piece called Mirage for cello, soprano, and orchestra. And there were certain things that would not leave me. And so I collected these things to make these five pieces. There are two of them which are bigger and where clearly cello is soloist, and then three smaller ones. And all of them, it's like there was this material which didn't want to leave. Sometimes it's quite simplistic, sometimes it's much more large, and so it's materials I have loved a lot.
You've loved a lot? Okay.
Yes.
And what about the relationship you want the musicians to have to one another?
To have with another?
The way, you know, the way they you want them to play, the way you want them to listen and be aware of one another.
Well, that's the fantastic thing about chamber music, of course, that you are making music with others. And here we have three very different instruments, in fact. And it's their discovery. It's their work. It's
have you observed this group finding particular things, discovering particular things in this piece?
I think they are really sensitive musicians and extremely skillful. I can just admire, but I think the sensitivity struck me really.
The interesting thing is when you hear serenatas, as you hear these five pieces, which are agitato, delicato, dolce, languido, and misterioso, you're all remembering that. I mean, there's a deeply sensual, often I think calm feeling to some of this music, and yet the percussion setup is pretty big, and the percussionist has to quite a lot of physical moving around in order to get to all the instruments. I mean, there's a kind of contradiction between the physicality that he needs to get around the setup and this beautiful limpidity and languidity of the music that he makes.
Yeah, poor percussionist. Yes. Yeah.
Kaya, look, the what are the big things that you want your music to do in the world? You know, you've talked about this, the idea of a chamber music set and the idea of a communication. I mean, what are the big things that you want it to do?
Can you ask a thing like that? I don't know how I could what I could answer, you know, because everybody has different, they come from different places, they have different feelings right now, and they will hear my music very differently. I wouldn't dare to ask something specific.
Okay. What do you hear different things in it all the time? This piece you've heard a lot. Serenatas was written in 2008, for example. I mean, you hear always different things in it yourself when you hear it?
Well, you know, I'm different because I'm the composer.
I think the reason I ask is because of the sense of what you do as a composer is a very private activity. You know, it's you and your imagination and your way of hearing the world, which you're writing onto pieces of paper, which you're then giving to people to play in large public context. Now, there's so much can happen that can change between how you hear and what everybody else is hearing and what the piece is. So, I mean, I think what I mean is what you're trying to do, to communicate as strongly as possible that private musical universe to us, to the listeners, to the world.
Well, that's what composition is about. But on the other hand, the moment when you are writing your music, that's not what you're thinking. You are not thinking that I hope billions of people hear this music. You know, at some point I try to step back and evaluate the music and ask myself, would it be satisfactory to hear? I try to take very cerebral attitude, but basically, but as you say, it's extremely private process and it's intellectual, but also with full of feelings. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are days that I'm asking myself, why would anybody like to hear this music? And why am I doing this work altogether? Because I could do much more important things. And then there are other days where I'm feeling that that's the only thing I can do well, if that even, and that there is some importance to try to communicate with music. I feel that I'm like filter, and I'm living today, and this music is filtered through me, and maybe it can give something for other people, and maybe it can open something. Maybe it's something they didn't experience elsewhere. So
that's what happens when I hear your music, so I'm sure it's what happens for people in the audience here and for everybody listening at home. Finally, Kaya, before we hear Serenatas, you told me you used to ask your mother to turn off the music that you were hearing in your head, that when you were at night you would put your head on the pillow and you would hear the music that you imagined was coming from the pillow, but it was in fact the music you were imagining. So you said to your mother, can you turn the music off? Is that still happening? Is your way of hearing still as sensitive as it was when you were a child, or maybe even more, the sense that you know that this music is coming through you and you hear it all around you?
It's difficult to say, because you know, when you are a child, you cannot analyze. I couldn't think that I was imagining music, or then I thought that everybody heard the same music. I didn't think that it was my imagination. Yes, I do imagine a lot of music, and I try also not to imagine it all the time. But I have a paper always next to my bed, because sometimes I dream music, and sometimes it bothers me. But it's my place. It's my escape place, and of course, differently now when I'm more than adult. But yes, it's my private place, and I hope it will stay.
Well, you see, this is the great thing. In dealing so analytically with the things that are private to you as in your world of imagination, what you give us are these fantastic musical dreams that we can all experience. Kaya, thank you. Look, we're going to hear Serenata's These Obsessions, These Dreams, played, five of them, agitato, delicato, dolce, languido, misterioso, played by Rebecca Herman, the cellist, Sam Wilson, the percussionist, and Leanne Cody on piano. Kaya Sarriahu's Serenatas.
Thank you.
Thank you.